Hello, everybody. This is John Marks from CopsAlive.com. I am pleased to offer you another edition of our Law Enforcement Audio Bulletin, or Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. Today's guest is Sergeant Clark Paris. He is a sergeant with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. He is also the creator of the website ThePainBehindTheBadge.com and a film documentary of that same name. He has been working to reduce suicide in our law enforcement ranks, and it's my pleasure to welcome Clark here today. Thank you, Clark, for joining us.
Well, thank you, John.
It is my pleasure. I have had a chance to see what you're doing. I'm very impressed. Thank you for all that you're doing for the other members of our profession. Would you please take some time here today to just sort of share your story and let us know what you're doing and why you're doing it?
Absolutely. Well, I've been a cop. I'm finishing my 25th year here in Las Vegas. And probably like most cops, early in my career, I thought stress wouldn't be a factor. And after all, you know, I was one of the few chosen to be a cop. So I thought I was exempt from that whole stress factor, even though they gave us a four-hour block on stress in the academy. And I'm going to tell you, John, kind of what led up to all this. But I go through my career, I'd say the first 20 years, and I joke at my seminars, I say I'm 5'8 and a half. and I always thought, you know, the guys, men and women were big and tough to be cops. And I was surprised when I got hired, but I was kind of proud that, you know, I saw a lot of bad stuff too, and it never fazed me, or so I thought.
Right.
You know, I did like most cops, I disassociated. And as I went through my career, like with anyone who's been a cop for any length of time, you see cops take time off, and they say that they're stressed or they're burned out or they quit. Some of them commit suicide. And, you know, I'm a little bit ashamed to say that I'd look at them and think they were a slug. Because
mm-hmm.
I would look at situations and I would say, I was there. It didn't bother me. You're milking the system. And it was probably about 4 years ago that I could feel something happening to me, and I started to struggle. Didn't know what it was. But I knew what it was, and it was not my job. After all, I was very proud to say, and this was my line, I thought I was original, but I found out I'm not the only one who says this. As far as those psychologists and those counselors go, I would say, you know what? When they put a badge on their chest and a gun on their side, then they can tell me how to do my job. Yeah, and everybody's, yeah, you go, Clark, me too. And, man, only now do I realize how ignorant I was. But what happened is I started to struggle, and I told you that because I knew it wasn't the job. I knew that. I have five kids. I would have bet their life that it wasn't the job. I just didn't know what it was. And what happened is I would find myself, you know, it started just with me getting emotional. And I joke about this with people that I could watch a Disney movie with my wife and kids, and I'd be the only one getting choked up. You know, and I would say it's allergies, or I'd act like I yawned or something. But it wasn't that bad, but I knew something was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a great employee assistance program in Las Vegas. And, you know, I wasn't going to call them because this is what I thought. You know, first of all, I've got two strikes against me. I'm a man and I'm a cop, so I knew it all.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to call them because I thought, you know what, I haven't killed anybody. And my partner hasn't been shot, so it can't be the job. I know that. And then I worked a part of town I had. I was responsible for 12 officers, and you know, it's busy in Vegas, like in the metropolitan area, and as a supervisor, you're required to respond to certain calls. One of those calls is suicide. We don't do a lot, but we do respond as a supervisor, and this particular day, and I have to preface with this, I don't think Las Vegas is a suicide capital of the world, and I could go weeks without going to a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have, I think, 7 area commands, 4,000 cops. So it's not just Clark Paris out there. But on this particular day, my squad had five suicides that I had to respond to. And I tell people, I could have called another sergeant and said, hey, you mind taking this? And they would have said, sure, Clark. But come on, I'm a cop.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to handle my call. And the two that I remember, one was an 83-year-old man with cancer. I can't say why I remember it, but I do. And the other was a 13-year-old boy who had failed algebra. And en route to the call, and again, I talked about in the seminars, I call these emotions that build up inside of us, I call them cop stew, because we take all these things that we think are nothing, like little pieces of celery or carrots, we put them in this big pot that starts to boil. And I could feel my pot boiling, and I knew this was going to be a tough call for me. And never in my career had this happened, but I've been dealing with my emotions for several weeks, and I arrive, and the officer's out front waiting for me, and there's a guy next door mowing his lawn, John. I see him. He's unrelated to this event.
Right.
And I go inside, and as I enter the house, there's maybe 12 or 13 people in the kitchen, and they're crying, and they're moaning, and they're making sounds that sound like wild animals. They were completely distraught.
Mm-hmm.
So I go into the officer takes me to the back room where the boy's body was, and I look in there and see it like I've seen so many, and just confirmed that the crime scene's secure and all the notifications have been made. And I'm walking out, and I talk to the mother, and I tell her the coroner's en route, and I ask if she has any questions, and I tell her about this counseling program we have. And I don't know what happened, but she ends up clinging to me, and she's bawling.
Mm.
And as I looked at her, I could see snot getting on my uniform. It was almost surreal. But I thought to myself, I've got to get out of here. Because, you know, as cops, we don't drop to our knees and cry at the crime scene like everybody else. But I maintained my composure, and I said to myself, I got to get out of here, and I did. And I got in my car, started it up and turned the air conditioning on. It was a typical comfortable 118-degree day in Vegas. and I broke down, and I started crying. I was bawling. That's never happened to me in my life. And in the midst of that, that guy who was mowing his lawn tapped on my window, and I looked up, and he said, "Excuse me, officer," and he stopped himself. And he was a good man, and he was genuinely concerned. He stopped himself, and he said, "Are you okay, officer?" And he was concerned for me.
Hmm.
I had never been so ashamed of myself in my life. I thought, what a coward that I'm a cop with the Las Vegas Metro Police Department, because we all think our agencies are the best.
Right.
And I'm a cop with the Las Vegas Metro Police, and I can't even handle a suicide because I had lost it. And I regained my composure, and I talked to him, and I went about my business, and that's why I referred that pot of cop stew had boiled over. But what happened is everything came back after that, and everything that came back, John, was work-related. And then I had to face the fact that maybe Clark Paris was wrong for 21 years. Maybe it is the job.
Yeah.
And I say that because from fights to stabbings to raped girls and molested children, it all came back, and it came back all of the time. And I was struggling. And I tell people, I would love to say that, you know, I wasn't suicidal, because I wasn't. But I think, and I say for the troopers that might be listening, I was going down that road. I just didn't hit that mile marker yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a great relationship with my wife. And I didn't know what to do, so I said, you know what, I'm going to tell my wife. I don't know what I'm going to say, but I'm just going to tell her, you know what, something's wrong with me. And it took a few more weeks, and she was in the pool one day. I don't know where our kids were. We got five. You know, a couple are grown, and we have three little ones. And I thought, this is my opportunity. I usually work in the yard, but I'm going to get in the pool, and I'm going to tell her. I had a two-faced plan. I'm going to say, I have to tell you something. That was phase one. And phase two is going to be, I think this job's getting to me. And eventually I got the courage. It took about 45 minutes, but I got the courage, and I went over to her in the pool, and I said, I have to tell you something, and I broke down again for the second time. And she just looked at me. My wife was 5'4", 100 pounds, soaking wet. And she's a registered nurse, and she's a sweetheart, but she can be a tough girl, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She's strict with her children. She's a great mom. And after I regained my composure, because she just looked at me, she said, what is it, honey? And she was concerned, and I regained my composure. And then I my phase two portion of the plan came out, and I said, I think this job's getting to me. And I felt like it took 1,000 pounds off my shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife looked at me, and she hates this part of the seminar, but her response was, and what I call sheer disgust, and I've heard it before with the kids, she looked at me, and her response was, are you kidding me? And I thought, what have I done? Because we have a perfect relationship. And you have to understand, this went on. This wasn't a 5 or 10 minute ordeal. It lasted all day. And I talked about every call I had been on. And you know, she started saying, what about the house? What are you going to quit your job? Or what are you having a breakdown? What about our kids? We've got one in college and three more to go to college. Clark, what was my Rock of Gibraltar, she called me. And all I could say is, I don't know. And eventually I said, you know what, I'm okay, because I was dehydrated from crying. I said, you know what, I'm okay. And I said, Nate, you know, I thought I was run over on my police motorcycle, and my back and my leg were broken. There was a shooting I was in. And I said, all these things, the dead babies, the rape, everything comes back, people hating me, CPR, and the man died. And she said, but we talk about this stuff. But eventually I said, you know what? I said, I'm okay. So I think I just had a weak moment. And my wife will say, at that moment, she realized I was putting that wall back up.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of us not knowing a whole bunch about police stress or cumulative stress or PTSD, that wall was going back up. That was what prompted me to make the movie The Pain Behind the Badge. I figured, you know, I'm a relatively stable guy, and this was destroying me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how many other cops are struggling? And I think my kids deserve more than that, and I deserve more. They would even kiss me, even my, you know, my 13-year-old who's bigger than me, still kisses me on the lips, says, good night, Daddy, I love you. And it was like 90% of my life was focusing on these bad things, and 10% was following my friends and family. And it was like I was looking from the outside in, and when I said, good night, son, I love you, it's like I wasn't even there. And I looked back, and if there's one thing to get me emotional, it's that, because, you know, I deserve better than that. I love my family, and they love me. And as we went through this, and I said, you know what, to my wife, even though I can't set my watch, I said, I'm going to make a documentary movie. And I went on, I must have been watching a lot of documentaries at that time or something, I don't know. But went on the internet, saw that there were none, so a guy in town, his dad's a cop, and his company's 100 Lot Productions, he said he would do it for free.
Wow.
You know, hoping that maybe this movie would become a big thing. And I sold everything I had and borrowed money and sent thousands of emails, and we made the movie. It features three cops, two who were suicidal and one whose marriage was falling apart. And dealing with the counselors and the psychologists, I say, if you would say, well, what do you think really helped? What's the factor, Clark, that made you okay? It was great to realize that it's normal for these bad things that we see to bother us. That was it, because I thought out of 870,000 cops in America, I was the only sissy. Me and all the ones who we know who have quit because they were sissies, I thought. But then you're going to come to find out more cops are bothered than are not.
Yeah.
I could list a dozen guys at work who have talked to me because of what I do now, and I think, man, you're the toughest guy I know. And they start to tell me something, and I start to get choked up. So I made this movie, and A&E didn't buy it or anything, and I didn't know what I was going to do, and then agencies called and said, well, do you do lectures? So we turned it into a seminar, and I talked to the officers, and they said, well, we're not really good sending them out. It's just a tough topic, PTSD and suicide. So they said, but if you're going to show the movie and be there to defend us if somebody starts passing us, we're good with that, because we want cops to see what we went through. So we created the Pain Behind the Badge LLC and the website, and now, you know, the movie's just 1 hour of an 8-hour seminar, and we talk about some topics that we've coined. One is perception protection, which is that we all know what the perception that society has of us. We used to have it of ourselves before we became cops. And I ask them, when I do the seminar again, I say, all of you who are cops, now that you're a police officer, is raise your hand if this job is what you thought it was going to be before you became a cop. And it's probably 0.1% will raise their hand.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's not quite what they thought.
Right.
We talk about perception protection and living up to that image that we in society have of ourselves that is really, really cool, but it's not realistic, and that's what's killing us. Mm-hmm. So we talk about that. We talk about the progression of stress, which is when we get involved in an incident and go from that zero stress level to 10 being the worst, which could be in a millisecond or years. We talk about that. And like I told you before the interview, we use an acronym known as SIPDE, but we've changed the meaning, and that's SIPDE, stands for scan, identify, predict, decide, and execute. And it's just a way for officers to just evaluate their own lives and say, hey, you know what? Because if you don't do that, you won't see the change.
Yeah.
But you can evaluate your life and say, you know what, I've changed. Something's wrong here. There's nothing wrong with drinking a beer or drink before you go to bed. But if you used to have one and now you have four or five, something probably caused it. And I always say there are no absolutes, because we had one lady stand up and said, what about those cops who just act like nothing bothers them? And there are some cops who see really, really bad stuff and they're okay. Everybody doesn't struggle. And it doesn't mean they're better, doesn't mean they're worse. It just means they're fortunate that they don't struggle. My wife, like I said, is a registered nurse and, you know, did a stint in the psych ward and has dealt with first responders and ER and trauma for 27 years. She talks about spousal involvement. She'll talk about that day in the pool and how, in retrospect, every sign that we talk about was there and she never saw them. And the purpose of her being there is if my wife didn't tell her portion for an hour and a half, mm-hmm. all those cops in good relationships would say, my wife or my husband or my spouse, they'd say, we've got a great relationship. That would never happen to us.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just have a couple of goals. We have one goal. We want to reduce police suicide. The other is to convince officers who are struggling that they're not alone and the help that's provided really works. There's a whole bunch of help out there, and it's not just one type. One doesn't work, go to another. Tell them, if you hire an electrician and you don't like the job he did and you still need electrical work, you just don't hire that electrician. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we do with the Pain Behind the Badge now. And we also, when we do the seminar, we sell these bracelets, and we're raising money for a scholarship so that each year we can give a scholarship to a son or daughter of a police officer who committed suicide. So that's kind of the seminar. That's kind of what the Pain Behind the Badge is as far as what we're doing. You know, we did Lakewood PD after the four officers were killed in the coffee shop. And we did Virginia Tech after the massacre. And we've done a whole bunch of stuff. And it's been really, really rewarding.
I commend you for all that you're doing. And your experiences are certainly what we're seeing. I think the big issue is that, as you already said, cops need to realize they're not alone. They're not the only ones having these kind of feelings. They're not the only ones having those kind of doubts. And they're not the only ones feeling that kind of stress. And I think we grow up in the job thinking, you know, unless I'm involved in a shooting or my partner gets shot, I'm going to be okay and I can handle it all. And we get taken off guard by all the stuff that accumulates. Every one of us has a different an analogy. I like your boiling pot analogy. But we collect all this stuff throughout our career, and sometimes we get caught off guard thinking, you know, I haven't been in a major critical incident, so why is this affecting me? And it's simply that it erodes your protection over a career, whatever that might be. Some people, as you said, don't get the effects as strongly as others, but I bet that the majority of us do, and the issue is trying to get us to admit it.
Well, sure. You know, one of the things I tell people is, in most cases, most agencies in America, to become a police officer or a sheriff or corrections or trooper, you've got to take a polygraph and a written and a physical agility and a psych, all this testing that you go through. You know, and it's the best process known to man to determine if someone is qualified.
Mm-hmm.
And we go through this, and if you pass, that means, and that agency will say, this man or this woman is going to make a great cop because they care about people, they're compassionate, they're brave, they're smart, they want to make a change, they're going to be a great cop. And then what I say is, now take that information and put it to the side and think about this. Now take that person and go to a world where there's violence and hatred and anger and racism and say, who would this world really, really mess up? Well, we know who. It would be the police, because they've been tested. We know what they're made of, and this world should destroy them, yet we think, well, it shouldn't bother me because I wear a badge now. And when I tell them that, there are so many people come up and say, I never thought of that. Never.
Yeah, I call it the RoboCop syndrome. I think we have created a myth, and we actually convince ourselves that we're completely invincible and we're completely macho and we can handle everything. And we forget, oops, wait a minute, we're human beings too, and you never know what's going to get you. It might be the death of a child that looks just like yours. It might be a few too many dead children, as in my case. It might be, accumulation of things or an auto accident involving somebody that reminds you of one of your grandparents. It could be almost anything that triggers it, but there's a good chance you've been collecting it for as long as you've been a cop.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I tell them that. I say, you know what, most people, if you think about this, most people will not see a dead body till grandpa or grandma dies.
Yeah.
And they think they see these shows and they go to monster movies and they know what it's like, and they don't.
Right.
But they don't see anybody dead until grandpa or grandma dies. And you can talk to any cop, and they can say, I've looked at dead people, and I know what they look like. But we think we should be okay. And every day, we get slapped in the face with a dose of reality. And I don't care what you say. That sometimes you need to have a little bit of fantasy in your life. And if every day you're reminded that you're going to die, and every day you say, I've got to be careful, it can get to some people. It can. And the one thing I stress is the counselors. You know, I was talking to an officer who went through some real bad stuff, and then they thought they had fixed him, and he had some more issues. And I talked to him this morning, and his struggle was from an incident in 1994. He said, I feel euphoric. Hmm. He went to the counselor Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and he said, man, I haven't felt like this since 1994. And it stemmed from him feeling responsible for a kid getting shot, that he wasn't responsible for it. For 16 years, it's been eating at him. And I said, can you just think how good your life would have been if you would have sought help in the beginning? 16 years he's been struggling, and he was suicidal. And you know, we talked also, you've got in Washington, they have, I think, Safe Call Now. And then in New Jersey, they have Cop to Cop.
Right.
And those are phenomenal programs. I don't know why we don't have something that is nationwide, but we don't.
Well, you know, everybody's working on it. I commend you for what you're doing, and what I'm seeing is that this is what it's about. It's about grassroots cops helping other cops and growing these initiatives until we take these problems away. And I always say that I'd rather we change our industry, our profession, than have somebody from outside start looking at us and say, you've got a problem and we're going to fix you. I think we need to do that, and I personally look at it as my legacy to the career that I loved. It is a chance to give back and a chance to give those people that are on the exact same path that I was on a better guide, a better route to take, perhaps. And, you know, I think cops respect that. They want to be conscious of these things. It's just we are flooded with so many things in training. And I wrote down, you talked about the 4 hours in the academy. When I went to the academy, I don't remember anything about stress management. I got some throughout my career, but you know, we're starting to see some changes where there are more and more discussions about these kind of issues. But in my opinion, we still don't have enough discussions about them, and the mechanisms to do something about it are still a little thin.
Oh, absolutely, I agree. And you know, I remember the 4 hours. Like I said, we have a great program. There are a lot. I've been all over the nation. Mm-hmm. There's some great programs, but they're just like body armor. If you don't wear them, if you don't use them, they don't work. And that's our struggle. Cops don't use that. They refuse to accept the help.
Yep.
Now, there, I think 2% of the agencies have a program geared directly towards the prevention of suicide. But there's a whole bunch. There are thousands of police chaplains and employee assistants and peer support, but they don't accept it. And going back, like you said, that 25, 30 years ago, you know, and we still have some Vietnam vets, but it wasn't acceptable to say this job's bothering me. You know, we had tough guys.
Yeah.
And they said, hey, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. And a lot of those guys went and committed suicide later.
Yeah.
But now, finally, because of people like you and some other organizations, cops can say, you know what, I'm not doing okay. Who do I talk to?
Yep.
That is the one change. But unfortunately, it's in its infancy still.
Yeah. Well, and cops are still afraid, and there are stories out there of officers seeking help and then losing their career, and that's what everybody's afraid of.
You're right.
We talk about being a family, but we're kind of a dysfunctional family, and so we as a family need to start looking at ways to actually help and do right and take care of our own instead of starting to shun people when they admit that they're human.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, the agencies I deal with, there's usually a significant amount of trust. Obviously, they brought me in. The chief or the sheriff brings me in. But there are a lot, and you hear those stories, because I might go to a seminar, and there could be 30 agencies there.
Mm-hmm.
you know, cops would come up and say, I can't go tell my boss, I'll be fired. They'll say, I'm not fit for business for work. So you're right, that is an issue, and I do believe it will change. It may take acts of Congress and laws, but until then, we have some of the other organizations, like what you're doing, and like I said, Safe Call and Cop to Cop. It will get there, but you're right. I'm not naive, and I don't think that I'm not looking at police work through rose-colored glasses, and I'm telling everybody, go to your boss, they'll fix you, because I know some of them cannot. But there are a lot of options out there, and I tell them, you know, the outside agent, the outside organizations, there are nonprofit organizations, there are psychologists, counselors, addiction centers. You can go in under an alias. You can go to the next county over. There are ways to save yourself.
Yeah.
And you got to take care of yourself before you can take care of your friends or family, so you got to do it. If you don't trust your agency, it does not mean you can't get help today.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are some of the things we talked about. Because I agree. Some people say, hey, I went to get help, and they fired me. That does happen. I know that. Be smarter than that. Make you a priority.
Yeah, I'm not going to be satisfied until we get to a point in, at least in the United States, and I want to talk about the rest of the world here in just a second, but I'm not going to be satisfied until we do enough training and we have as much talk about taking care of ourselves as we do about officer survival and hand-to-hand combat and arrest techniques and shooting and driving. I mean, those are all important. I'm not trying to diminish any of those, but we need to make some room for this because this is a long-term investment in our human resources, and that's where it's at. We need, we all know that there aren't enough cops out there. We can't be losing the good ones we've got. And
I agree,
we need 100%, to take care of each other.
100%, I agree.
Before we started, you and I were talking about kind of the fact that this is not just a U.S. problem. It is a global problem in law enforcement.
Sure. Well, you know, anyone can Google police suicide. And you and I were talking about India. It just seems like they pop up every day, or Pakistan. And one of the things I always stress is you could go back 240 years ago when this nation fought for our independence, or you can go to India, or you can go to China, where the people's skin is a different color, they speak a different language. But if you think about this, moms and dads love their kids the way we love ours. They value life the way we value life. And in most cases, they love their country the way we love ours.
Mm-hmm.
So the human part of police work, that is the one and only common denominator, is that we are all human beings. We're not robots. And what we see in every other nation, the police are supposed to keep the community safe and protect the innocent. It really is the same. And they go to the rapes and the murders just like we do in America, and they struggle.
Yep.
Just like we do, because they're human beings. So it definitely, that is the number one common denominator, I believe, is cumulative stress and PTSD.
Yeah. Yep, I agree. I feel for the police officers in other countries that don't have the kind of resources we have, and in many cases have much more violence than we have. I mean, look at the countries that are in the midst of either civil unrest or war. And you hear about police officers being killed in the dozens almost daily, and you wonder, why would anybody sign up for that kind of a job where their police station gets bombed or you know, three or four police officers are gunned down? And that makes what we've got here in the States look pretty trivial compared to what some of the people around the world are dealing with. And yet there are still those brave souls that step up to the plate and take the badge or take the oath or whatever is involved, and go out there probably with less equipment than we're given, and they try to do the same job we're doing, and that's to take care of their people and their society, and you know, God bless them all. We need to find a way as a group to look after our own, and I think personally that means everybody around the world.
I agree. You know, one of the organizations pushes heavily for annual psyche valves, and some people agree with that and some they don't. It's a tough time to get departments to dish out more money for a psyche valve every year for an officer. But I'm going to give you my opinion of that. Because
yep.
Some people say cops are going to go and they're just going to lie.
Yep.
You know what? Some will. Some will. Some will go and they won't be able to lie. But you know what's great? If they made it mandatory, it allows those cops who are struggling, once they get in there and shut the door, they can tell that doctor, I'm not doing okay. But they can say to their buddies, yeah, I had to go for my annual eval. So it is a good thing. I just think it's difficult right now when agencies are laying people off, say, we want you to pay more money for psyche valves. That's the hurdle.
Yeah.
you know, and people, different organizations are coming up with different ideas, and I believe it will get there. There's strength in numbers. Civil litigation causes change. A lot of stuff's going on. Time's on our friend. Like I said, you've taken the initiative to do this, and other groups have, and I have, and it will. It's just I feel like right now we're nothing more than a granule of sand on the beach of stress. That's all.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating.
Well, I think the issue with annual avowals is that, you know, it scares people to death. There are people that know
yep.
there's something wrong and they don't want to admit it. And you start talking about something like that and it scares them to death because then they really do believe they're going to lose their job. And the good news
Absolutely.
Is, I don't think people believe this, but the good news is once you go into that door and close the door and start actually dealing with things, the path back to feeling confident and secure and comfortable again is a whole lot easier than the path that you're going to continue to go down if you don't deal with it. And that one frequently ends in some sort of death, destruction, or even a suicide.
Absolutely. And you know what? I said earlier about, you know, when you put a badge on your chest and a gun on your side, they don't want to be cops. They're good at what they do. That's what they want to do. That's why they do it.
Yep.
And there's not going to be one answer to this. I don't think someone's going to come up and say, look what I discovered. This is going to fix everything. Whatever the fix is going to be, it's going to be multifaceted. There's not one thing that can fix this problem. I don't have the answer. But whatever it is, it's going to have to be several things because we've got a million cops in America. I don't know how many in the world. And everybody's different. One person might be good at EMDR. One might see a counselor. One might see a psychologist. It's different strokes for different folks, as they say.
Yeah.
So whatever the fix is going to be, it's not going to be one thing.
I agree with you, and the bottom line is we're doing what we need to do. We're talking about it. I thank all of you that are listening, and, you know, I think Clark would say the same thing. Go talk about this. Spread the word. Use our websites. Send people there. Use us as an excuse. Talk about it at roll call. Talk about it with your friends. If you're going to sit around and drink beer, this might be a good discussion. You know, the problem is we don't talk about some of our stresses often enough, and that's part of the problem. So,
you know,
I've advocate more discussion.
Yeah, I've answered over 22,000 emails. I answer every single one of them. And people send me emails. I'm not a counselor. Don't claim to be. But I cannot tell you how many people I've said, do me a favor. Make an appointment to see a professional and then send me an email. Let me know how it went. And every single one, it starts off usually with a capital block, thank you. Because I answer every email, so I encourage anyone, if they want to ask something or tell me something, shoot me an email, thepainbehindthebadge.com. I will answer it, promise.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, can you share with us a little bit of information about how to contact you and how to learn more about the seminar and the documentary film?
Sure. You know what? Well, the website is www.thepainbehindthebadge.com. It's all one word. And, you know, we do different seminars with different agencies. We're doing a big one here in Las Vegas with Colonel Dave Grossman, October 7th and 8th at the Palace Station. So it's a day with Dave Grossman, and his topic is the bulletproof mind. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, day two is the pain behind the badge. So it's two full days of training, and I think it's reasonably priced. It's $150 for both days, and it's a 10% discount if they book it before August 7th. But that's one. And then we do different seminars at conferences and all that kind of stuff. But we don't usually put the seminars on the website when they're sponsored by a police agency, but we might start that because most of the agencies who bring us in open it up to all the other jurisdictions. The thing I would stress is if somebody says, I think I'm going to go to that, bring your spouse. Bring them because we stress it. The sponsoring agencies stress that you need to bring your spouse, and I would say 5% bring them. But 90%, when it's over, come up and say, I wish I would have brought my wife, or I wish I would have brought my husband or girlfriend or whatever. Mm-hmm. We hear it every single time. So then they've got to wait and go to another seminar. I hope we come back in a year or two. But bring them. They'd be surprised. And I can't tell you how many men have said, well, my wife doesn't want to know. She can't handle it. And they go to the seminar, and I say, man, that was amazing. I never thought of that stuff. Thank you. And I'm not saying I'm the fix-all or that the pain behind the badge is. We're just another resource, and we can direct people to help, or I can call someone and ask what this cop needs to do, but at least it's a start. If somebody says, I'm struggling and I don't know what to do, that phone call to somebody or that email is the first step.
Yeah.
And for me, it took a long time. to do anything.
Yep. Yeah, but you're pretty typical from what I've heard, and yet, you know, more of us need to tell that story because there are plenty of them out there that don't believe it. And I was one of them at the time. So, you know, we all just sort of have to learn at our own speed, and we all have to take stock of our own lives at our own pace, I guess. And my feeling is I just need to keep telling the story until, you know, people listen. And some, you know, in every group, there are going to be some that listen and some that won't.
But, absolutely.
The good news is those that listen are spreading the word, and that's the important thing.
Well, I love, I remember vividly my first day in the police car and my big badge and the shiny boots, and I knew at every intersection, every single person was looking at me. I just knew it. They were looking at the cop in the car, you know? And one of the things I tell police officers is, that hasn't stopped. We changed. They didn't. They're still looking at you. They still look at your boots and your gun and your taser, and they think, man, that's cool. That, look at that. That is the stuff. We let it become something regular and let it get to us and say, I'm not going to fix this and continue for it. Try to continue loving this job and enjoying it.
Yeah.
But we're the ones who cause the change. We don't get help when we need it. The people still look at us like, wow, there's a cop. And trust me, so next time, for those who are listening, if you go into a coffee shop or a restaurant and you're standing there and you're looking at the clerk, turn around real quick and look at everybody who's staring at your gun belt and your boots and your taser. And if you catch them, they'll go, oh, hey, officer, because they're wondering, what would it be like, or what do you do, what's it like in your world? They still look and they still like the police. 99.9% of America loves the police.
Yeah.
And the ones who don't like us, in my opinion, shame on them. Well, then I don't like you. I'll still do what I have to do because it's my job. You don't have to like me because the rest of the world does. Because what we do is right and it's honorable and it is a great profession.
Very cool. I have to ask you before we wrap up, what's the future of the film? I know that when you originally created it, you'd hope to, you know, to get it to take a kind of a different path than it has. And have you given up those hopes?
I'm sure. Like everything else with time, we're going to be able to release it, and as soon as we can, we will.
Yeah.
As soon as we can, we will. I've been thinking about maybe a little bit a sequel, because a topic that comes up a lot in the emails that I get is cops say, hey, are you going to do anything to address stress related to workers' comp or on-duty injuries?
Yep.
John, that is tens of thousands of people. And when you've got the job where you're the man or you're the woman or whatever you are, because you're the protector of your community, and you get hurt and the doctor says, you're not going to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That is a huge psychological blow.
Yep.
And then we can get off on a whole bunch of tangents about addiction and all kinds of stuff. But I cannot tell you how many police officers have said, hey, are you going to address or make a movie or do anything about work-related injuries, because, man, there are so many.
Yeah.
You think about it. It's a tough job. We fight. We get in wrecks. We do all the stuff that on TV, they never get work. They never get workers' comp injuries.
Yeah.
But in real life, we do.
Yep.
And that's a huge stressor for these police officers. When they go to the doctor and he or she says, look, you might have to retire or you might lose your job or maybe you're just going to be on the desk. And every cop says, but that's not what I want.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you're going to do. That's tough.
Yep. Yeah, it's
and
something that young officers don't think
of. Say, well, look, you do the other part of police work, and it's really important, and without you, we couldn't do it. And that's true, but it's not what you want to hear when you didn't want to be injured.
Yep.
So that, as far as the film, that's one of the questions I'm really, really, I never thought of this, even as a person who was injured. And I remember that doctor saying, you'll probably never be full duty again. It was all I could do not to cry in that office.
Yeah.
Because the day before, they were saying I was fine. Fortunately, they fixed me, and I'm good. But that was tough. One day, I'm a motorcycle cop, and I'm thinking tomorrow I'm going to be on a desk for the next 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm seriously have been kind of toying with that a little bit. Just there's a lot of cops out there who will come forward and say, I'll tell you my story.
Yeah. Yep.
And you know, and they feel like it's not fair when, hey, I got in a fight with a drunk or a bad guy, or a robber, or whoever they fought with, and now they're injured for life, and that guy got a $250 fine for disorderly conduct or something. That just adds to the stress. I will suffer forever. And they foo-fooed it.
Yep.
So who knows? I would like to maybe try that and just add to it. But as far as this specific movie, I am confident it's not going to be locked up forever. Trust me on that. It's just what's good is the seminar adds so much more, and that's what people say after we do it. When we first started the seminars, people would say, can we get the movie? And we didn't release it. No one even asked. They say, man, that was you brought up some great points. And it's not that I'm the Wizard of Oz or anything. I just feel like I'm one who decided to step in front of people and say, I'm going to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I want to tell you the truth and say it's normal. Because, well, I skipped this part, John. When I started, I didn't tell anybody my story about the pool. And one day I was talking to the cops in the movie, and I said, you know what, hey, you're my hero. And thank you for what you've done. I said, you're brave. No, out of all the cops I talked to, only three would sit in front of the camera. Thank you for what you're doing. You're saving lives. And then again, I thought, what a coward. How can I say that to them? And I'm not even telling the truth. And when I started adding that first hour of the seminar about my day in the pool, that's when the success started. That's when the walls were broken down. The cops would come up and say, let me tell you my story. And I can't tell you how many get emotional or they tell these stories that make your head spin. But not until, you know, I put my heart on my sleeve and said, I'm going to tell you what I went through and why I'm here today. And even with everything I did, I had made a movie and I had talked to counselors, but I still wasn't telling people what really prompted it because I was ashamed.
Yeah.
I was embarrassed. But I will say, when I finally told the story and said, this is what happened, man, it was... If I were a heroin user, I'd have to say that's the high I got. It felt so good to say, this is what happened, and this is why I did it, because so many people come up and say, hey, me too, Clark, me too.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of behind the badge, we don't spend enough time thanking the wives behind the badge, the support behind the badge. There are an awful lot of mechanisms out there that we rely on and frequently don't give enough due to those people, and, you know, I agree with you. Sometimes...
Yeah, and like I said, my wife talks for about an hour and a half in the seminar, and one more thing I want to mention is our kids.
Yeah.
Because most of us, we're cops throughout our children's lives, and they grow up, and you don't realize that they worry. They worry. You know what? We were going to surprise my son who's getting his braces off. And usually we plan this stuff, but we were going to surprise him. Went to school with the balloons and everything, and he was in eighth grade. We go to the attendance office, and they go to get him, and we're waiting. And he comes, and he's a good kid. He's a tough boy. I don't know, he plays football. He wrestles. I mean, he's a good boy. And we're sitting waiting, holding these balloons, because we're going to go to the orthodontist, get his braces off. And he comes busting through the doors at the office, crying. And my wife said, honey, what's wrong? You know what he said?
Mm-mm.
I thought Dad was shot.
Oh.
We never, never even thought of that, that he sits in school and thinks something's going to happen to his dad.
Yeah.
Because he just like, we don't want to tell anybody. Our kids don't want to tell anybody.
Yep.
But he just knew that if they came and pulled him out of class, he hadn't done anything wrong. He thought, they're going to tell me my dad's been killed. That's what he thought. And I'm telling you, he was bawling.
Wow.
We started to cry because he was so upset. And thought, man, I never thought that I need to talk to my kids. And we did. We had a little family meeting, and we talked about, you know, we're trained. We definitely have the advantage over the bad guy. You know, not many cops get killed. We're trained. We know how to protect ourselves. Had to tell them that we're going to be okay. And the odds of that happening, that scenario that you have put together in your mind, will most likely never happen. And he felt so good that I just said, that's probably not going to happen, Nick. I'm careful. I'm safe. I wear my body armor. We train all the time. And with a million cops in America, one every 2 days isn't. It's not a probability that it's going to be Dad. I just had to say, son, don't go to school every day thinking that I'm going to die, because that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
And it's not like I sit at home and tell these terrible stories about how dangerous the job is. I really don't even talk about it. But that was an eye-opener, because you're talking about thanking the wives and our kids. It really, the whole family, as proud as they are of us, Was it Newton said for every action is equal and opposite reaction? Mm-hmm. As proud as they are of us, they are scared for us too.
Yeah.
But they don't tell us that. So it's good when you're involved in it and you say, I'm going to be okay, and this is what we do. You know, television, I love TV and movies, but man, it doesn't help our profession too much.
Yeah, the big problem is we watch the stuff and it starts to get into our minds.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Clark, I want to thank you very much for being our guest. I want to thank you for all that you're doing. There just aren't enough of you out there doing what you're doing, but keep up the good work. And I encourage people to send emails and go visit www.thepainbehindthebadge.com and check out the seminars. Clark, thanks very much.
John, thank you. Thanks for all you're doing, too. Appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. It is my privilege. This is John Marks. You have been listening to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. Cops Alive was founded to help law enforcement professionals around the world plan for happy, healthy, and successful lives both on the job and beyond. Stay safe out there, and thanks for listening.